The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. We've got a lot of what I hope you'll find is very interesting news from Europe today. Last time I was on this show, we were talking about some forecasts for 2018, some of the big things that some forecasters were watching, how that aligned with things that the Trumpet has been watching for a long, long time. Well, today I want to focus on one specific trend that you probably have heard very, very little about that could be one of the big stories to come out from 2018 in Europe. And that is, watch for conflict in 2018 in Europe. This could be a very big year for that. This could be, there's already indications that this could be the year that the gloves come off, that some of these subterranean fights come out into the open. Plenty of opportunities for conflict between the big powers. There are really a lot of major divisive problems for Europe, and the upshot of these problems, of this conflict, of this possible collapse of the European Union, is something that's going to have some earth-shaking implications. So is 2018 going to be the year the EU collapses? Well, here's a look at three trends right now that could tear it apart. The first is nationalism. Nationalism is an unexploded bomb for Europe. Every few years, people are finding unexploded bombs left over from World War II, usually in British or German cities. They're dropped during World War II. For whatever reason, they didn't go off. They sunk in the ground and they're forgotten about. The years go by and the bomb is still there. And then when they find them, they have to get rid of them because the potential is still there for them to explode and cause a whole load of damage, especially if they're disturbed, if people start moving the earth around them. So, for example, just this week, just yesterday and the day before, there were two unexploded bombs found in building sites in Warrington, not far from Liverpool. And again, they had to evacuate people from their homes and clear them up. In Frankfurt last year, they had to evacuate over 60,000 because they found a very large unexploded bomb. But what I want to talk about is really a metaphorical unexploded bomb that, or several unexploded bombs buried within Europe, left over from World War II and other wars, that if they get disturbed too much, they could explode. And they're getting disturbed now more and more. And those are those unexploded bombs are various different nationalisms. This did really make a comeback in 2017 in ways that's more than just we don't want immigration, but a much more specific kind of way, whether you had lots of these different ethnic groups saying, we're not sure we want to be part of this country. We want our own nation, or we want to be part of a separate nation. Now, the right of ethnic self-determination, or the right of each ethnic group to determine which country they're a part of, how they're governed, that's right at the heart of the UN Charter. But at the same time, everyone's completely ignored it for Europe. Because this idea of nationalism and ethnic self-determination has been right at the core of the massive conflicts we've seen within Europe in the 20th century. The right of each ethnic group to determine its own future sounds great. It's proven a disaster in Europe. Paul Johnson wrote about this in his History of the 20th Century called Modern Times. And he wrote, violent ethnic nationalism both dictated the nature of the Versailles settlement that was after World War I and ensured that it would not work. In Central and Eastern Europe, the violence and the racial antagonism which provoked it were most acute, widespread, and protracted. A score or more minor wars were fought there in the years 1919 to 1922. They're poorly recorded in Western histories, but they left terrible scars. And these scars, he wrote, contributed directly to the chronic instability in Europe between the wars. The Versailles Treaty, in seeking to embody the principles of self-determination, actually created more, not fewer minorities, and much angrier ones. Many were German or Hungarian, armed with far more genuine grievances. Each country was landed with either an anguished grievance or an insuperable international problem. And this led to so many conflicts that Johnson, other historians like Fritz Stern, have just talked about a 30-year war that began in 1914. And just basically for a lot of Eastern Europe, there was just continuous fighting all the way through to 1945. And so after World War II, it's unsurprising they decided, well, we're not going to go with nationalism, with self-determination for Europe. Instead, they just kind of came up with a set of borders and decided, well, we're going to leave them there. We won't withdraw them except by mutual consent. It left many different minorities in countries, in other countries, you know, lots of Hungarians and Romania, etc. But they just left that because attempting to undo this just brought the whole system down. Because there are no neat ways of undoing this. If you take the bits of Romania that have majority Hungarians and give it to Hungary, well, there's still subdivisions, sub-regions within those regions where there's majority Romanians. And if you give those back to Romania, well, then you've got these little islands of Romania inside Hungary, or it becomes a mess very quickly. If you start looking at maps of, you know, ethnic makeups of Europe, it becomes very clear that there's no nice, neat borders you can draw to solve this problem. So this problem was ignored. Everyone just decided not to talk about it for fear of what could happen. That was the settlement after World War II, and people have been starting to mess with that settlement more and more. The watershed moment was really the breakup of Yugoslavia in 1990, in the early 1990s, where that completely went against this convention of no unilateral border withdrawings in Europe. And I think the countries involved in doing that, like Germany, they hoped that would be a one-off. Then you had Russia came and, you know, they took that precedent and they ran with it. They used that same precedent and they brought that up when they talked about Georgia, when they talked about breaking Crimea off from Ukraine. And then the big way that this precedent was questioned in 2017 was Catalonia. And we had some of the same discussions about ethnic self-determination on this show at the peak of the Catalonia crisis. And this is something that's now back in the news. Catalonia, just to recap, they voted for independence last autumn. The government responded by taking over the region, declaring the referendum illegal, ending the government and calling for fresh regional elections in Catalonia. They held those fresh elections in December. Oh, and before I go, it's also important to note that the government put out warrants for the arrest of all of the main leaders, the separatist leaders in Catalonia. Those political leaders that led the independence movement, they arrested a lot of them, and they're now facing long, long jail sentences. Then in December, you had the election, but the government was hoping that the anti-independence forces would win that election, and they didn't. The pro-independence parties have a majority in parliament. Now, they are quite divided, and there are a lot of different pro-independence factions. So it's not necessary that this is going to lead directly to a renewal of that clash, but it could well do so. Charles Puigdemont, he was Catalonia's leader before the election. Spain wanted to imprison him. And we're back to political prisoners in Europe, which is just a stunning development that I will very quickly gloss over. But anyway, he wanted to flee arrest. He fled to Brussels, and he could well be elected the leader of Catalonia again, despite not actually being able to set foot in Spain. Bloomberg has been writing, they've had a couple of articles over the last few days talking about Catalonia's government by Skype that they could be coming up with. The lawyers are all having a go over the different documents because some of these anti-independence factions want to elect Puigdemont. He, by law, is required to present his program to the parliament chamber. He's arguing that, well, he can present his program over video conferencing, over Skype, that he doesn't actually have to be present in order to present this program. Other lawyers are arguing the opposite. But you're seeing the potential anyway for this renewal of conflict in Catalonia. But in many ways, Catalonia let the cat out of the bag on this, or increasingly let the cat out of the bag. let more cats out of the bag. I probably should have thought that idiom through a bit more before using it. The moral of the story is think about your metaphors, otherwise they end up not making sense. Anyway, they let some more cats out of the bag, we'll go with that, in this ethnic nationalism problem in Europe. And now more people are taking that and running with my weird metaphorical cats. This is coming from Austria and Italy, and it's a much more dangerous divide. Because here it pits Austria, part of the prosperous north, against Italy, part of the poorer south. Now, on January 16th, Austria's foreign ministry announced that the nation was going to begin talks on giving Austrian citizenship to nearly 400,000 Italians living in a region of northern Italy. This region is called South Tyrol. It's basically in the kind of the Italian Alps and these alpine valleys there. And this is in some ways Italy and Austria's frozen conflict. You may have probably heard about frozen conflicts, usually in context of Russia. After the fall of the Soviet Union, there were all kinds of these different disagreements where you had separatist groups or two countries claiming the same piece of territory. And eventually there'd be a ceasefire. So nobody's fighting right now, but both sides still disagree. And none of the issues have been solved. And so they're called frozen conflicts. They still disagree with each other. They've just agreed to not fight right now. The conflicts are on ice. And this, in some ways, is Austria and Italy's deep frozen conflict. One that's been ignored for so long that quite a few have forgotten that it exists. So this South Tyrol region, it's northern Italy or just south of western Austria, just south of Innsbruck. And this used to be part of the Habsburg Empire. It was broken away from Austria and given to Italy in 1919 because the Austro-Hungarian Empire was on the losing side of World War I. But many in Austria want it back, and many in South Tyrol want to go back to Austria. They would rather be part of Austria than Italy, and I think polls indicate that a majority would prefer to go back to Austria. And so Austria is now scratching that itch by this new proposal that the new government is really working hard on to give passports to those in the region that speak German. Which, this is exactly the kind of thing that Vladimir Putin normally does before he invades somewhere. He gives the Russians, everybody who speaks Russian, a Russian passport, and then he invades claiming that he's protecting Russian citizens. So now Austria is getting ready to give passports to those that speak Austrian or those that speak German in this region. And it's not a small minority for this whole area. About 70% in South Tyrol speak German. So they're looking at giving out Austrian passports to 70% of the people there. So that's a big shift. And it's not hard to see then how that could really accelerate calls for South Tyrol to go from Italy back to Austria. If 70% of the people are Austrian citizens anyway, a majority, wouldn't it be better to give it back? That's the way you could easily see this going. And so understandably, Italy is very annoyed about this. The Italian president of the European Parliament, Antonio Tajani, he's already spoken out against this. He said, Europe has many shortcomings, but it has left the era of nationalisms behind. Well, have they? There's a Secretary of State serving in the Foreign Ministry. They accused Austria of using an iron ethno-nationalist fist. He wrote that to grant citizenship based on ethnicity would have extremely serious consequences elsewhere. For instance, in the Balkans, it could lead to the resurgence of territorial demands, which would impact the peaceful coexistence of countries in the EU too. Because remember, they're starting to mess with one unexploded bomb within Europe, and there are many of these other unexploded bombs buried all around Europe. And they're doing more than just talking about giving them citizenship, though this is the most extreme demand. They're also talking about allowing people living in this region of South Tyrol in Italy to serve in the Austrian armed forces and start recruiting them into the Austrian army. They're talking more as well about bringing South Tyrol's regional government into Austrian discussions and Austrian local government. So, for example, Western Austrian regions had a regional meeting just recently, and they invited the governor from South Tyrol along as well, and local politicians there to come and join with kind of the rest of Western Austria and to start treating them more and more that way. Heinz Christian Strache, who's a key member in the Free Democrat, or the Free Austrian Freedom Party, that's now a part of the governing coalition. He's demanded in the past the return of former Austrians to their native country. So you're seeing this being brought more and more into. We're talking about bringing this into Austria, and South Tyrol's very happy about this. It's been welcomed by the mainstream Conservative Party. And Germany is very heavily involved in this as well. They're supporting German speakers. The Christian Social Union in Bavaria has long ties to the movement to have this region of northern Italy brought into Austria, especially Franz Josef Strauss. He was accused of having some fairly substantial ties to this area. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But just a quote from German Foreign Policy. They write that German national foreign political organizations have regularly supported German-speaking organizations in this area and supported them both politically and materially. The most important party in the province, the South Tyrolean People's Party, has always cooperated closely with the German CSU. And here's another. This is from their article on January 16th. It was only published in German, but they wrote, "Violent conflicts cannot be ruled out." And you can see why, because in the 50s and 60s, there were terrorists in this region in Italy who wanted independence. And Franz Josef Strauss was accused of supporting the terrorists and providing material support to these terrorists. I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked into it too much, whether how credible these accusations are. Maybe he just sympathized with their aims. I think that perhaps is more likely. But there's that tie there to the CSU and to Germany. So there were terrorists there carrying out attacks in the 50s and 60s, trying to get this area independent or move it closely to Austria. Going back to this German Foreign Policy article, they wrote, "The most recent South Tyrol offensive is taking place at a time when nationalist organizations are on the offensive in many parts of Europe, including Spain, Belgium, and Romania. Proponents of Austrian citizenship for German-speaking northern Italians point out that Italy has passed its own law and issued Italian passports to citizens of Slovenia and Croatia of Italian descent. At the same time, critics warn that Austria will pass the law planned by the ultra-right-wing coalition so that an avalanche of similar steps in various other EU states cannot be ruled out. The respective conflicts could dangerously escalate at any time." So they're saying we can't rule out violence here. There's the possibility even for violent conflict right at the heart of the EU, Austria and Italy, two modern major Western European powers. Open Democracy had an article on this back in December. They wrote that this whole issue was a throwback to the upheavals of the first post-war period. 500,000 South Tyroleans can still feel the icy reverberations of that time, they wrote. Others know this too. They peer anxiously, though everyone's holding a different lens. And this conflict has the potential to get really interesting when you consider it in light of the points we'll get into next. And that is Germany. It seems like they're getting ready to throw their weight around much more. This is the second point that could lead to increased conflict in Europe in 2017, Germany throwing its weight around. This no more Mr. Nice Germany. Now, Germany's coalition agreement, Mr. Flory talked about that a little bit on Monday, and it was very pro-Europe. It was a 28-page document. The first three pages were all about Europe, and it had a lot of radical proposals for Europe. I wrote about it in my trumpet brief that went up on our website on Monday. You can go to our website and read that. And if you haven't already subscribed to the Trumpet Brief, I'd really urge you to do that. It's a publication we're always looking to improve and tweak and get better. We've made a few changes just even recently to try and make it easier for you to see all the various different links and articles that we link to in that. But that's a daily email that summarizes the top news of the day from our website and includes a message, personal message from trumpet writers, usually Mr. Flurry and Mr. McDonald and the trumpet managing editor, Mr. Hilliker. So I wrote about that on Monday. And then on Tuesday, Wolfgang Munchau in the Financial Times had an article called "A German Coalition Deal to Radically Reshape Europe." That's what this coalition deal looks at. And he writes, "But if the parties involved, the Christian Democrats led by Chancellor Angela Merkel and the Social Democrats, do manage to pull it off, it would be truly radical in one respect. The section on the future of the EU lays out the biggest push by Germany towards continental integration since the Maastricht Treaty a quarter of a century ago. In the last Grand Coalition deal in 2013, there were hardly any references to Europe beyond the usual clichés. The big issue then was the national minimum wage. But in last week's agreement, Europe is the number one item. This section goes way beyond a general willingness to engage with the French President Emmanuel Macron on Eurozone reforms. It declares a readiness to expand the EU budget with a larger German net contribution. It specifically supports a Eurozone budget to fund macroeconomic stabilization, social convergence, and structural reforms." He writes, "The way I read it is that this European stability mechanism that this document called, or the rescue umbrella, would be part of an enlarged EU budget and not as now run by member states. This is exactly what Jean-Claude Juncker, European Commission President, demanded. And he's always demanding a United States of Europe. That's why he's demanded this. And Germany's coalition negotiation document is a big step, if they can put it into practice, in this direction. They're right, he must be delighted. It marks a momentous shift away from the intergovernmentalism of Ms. Merkel towards a more integrationist position." He writes that it would require a formal treaty change, which itself must be agreed by all member states. France and Germany may start off with a coalition of the willing and take it from there. The coalition deal made by the recently formed Dutch government names the exact opposite objective: no further strengthening of the Eurozone. Can France and Germany really proceed without the Netherlands? Will the Netherlands change its view if Germany does? What is certain is that it will be tough going all the way. So there's just the potential for more conflict in Europe just with that, just with this new push for integration. Tough to get the SDP's party congress on January 21st to back formal coalition talks. Tough to get the SPD members to approve a coalition agreement. And even tougher to get all 19 Eurozone members to agree to reforms. So even that alone could lead to more conflict in Europe. But the most remarkable part for me from the Friday's document is, well, actually, sorry, I'll just read what he writes about his most remarkable part, and then I'll talk about mine. He says, "Perhaps the most remarkable part about Friday's document is that it signals a shift from Ms. Merkel's non-committal managerial style to a more agenda-driven politics. We are approaching a new era." And he could well be right about that, this new era. But to me, what stood out about it is that Germany could be preparing to get tough with Europe. And they had they're talking about tough sanctions. The European Observer wrote that the agreement hints at the possibility of linking the EU budget to political conditions when it states that reciprocal solidarity must also count for the EU budget. And as they note, solidarity is often a code word for taking in refugees. But what you're looking at doing is that the EU could cut off funding to nations if they go against what the EU wants. So each EU nation pays in quite a substantial amount. I think it averages to somewhere roughly 1% of Europe's economy gets paid in to the European Union. So a substantial amount of money gets paid into the central pot. All the nations of the EU get something back, but the poorer nations get much more back than they put in. And this Germany's saying, well, we want to change it so that if you don't do what we want, well, you still have to pay that money in, but you're not getting anything back. We're going to put fines on you. We're going to curtail that money. And this is a huge step for Europe. I mean, you think about Europe being originally sold as a free trade area. This is way beyond a free trade area. This is what you're looking at is voters in Poland, in Hungary, and these other countries voting and saying clearly in the polls, we don't want more migrants. Whether you agree or whether you disagree with them on that decision, that's a fundamental part of national sovereignty, being able to decide who comes into your borders. That's something that should be, that just according to all traditional politics, would be the decision of the voters to make. And now Germany's saying, well, we want to change that. We want to be able to overrule Polish voters or Hungarian voters, wherever. If they vote for something that we don't like, we want to be able to put fines on them. That's a big shift for Europe. And it's a big, it's a shift, an incremental shift for Germany. Really much being much more open about throwing their weight around. I mean, they did this in the Euro crisis. They did this in terms of enforcing various different conditions on individual nations, for example, to get a Eurozone bailout. But here they're looking about putting blanket provision into the European, for the whole of the European Union. You stay within our lines, or if you step outside, you're getting a fine. And we had just the week before, I wrote about the end of the good Germany, which, as the Spiegel put it, where Germany's foreign minister was saying, well, we need to start eating meat. We can't be a vegetarian into the day's world. We need to stand up much more assertively for our own interests. And then this is the coalition document that comes out of that. Is this Germany putting that into practice? But think about what this will mean for Europe if they start acting this way. And even if the coalition document falls through, they don't get their government, which could well happen. This is still the way that German leaders are thinking about acting in Europe now. Just in general, it shows a newfound willingness, the fact that they'd even put this in their coalition document, it shows a newfound willingness to throw their weight around, to impose what they want on Europe. And this is something, if they start acting that way, that's going to generate a lot of opposition. You know, if they start telling Hungary or Poland, you've got to accept more migrants, or we'll cut off your funds. You know, this is something that's going to start talks of Poland leaving the European Union. Hungary leaving the European Union. They're going to push back against that hard. And so you can see that really leading to, again, more conflict, more disagreements within Europe. So if 2018 is the year Germany throws its weight around, which it really looks like it will be, other nations are going to react to that, and it's going to be much more divisive. And you could see Germany really having to use that weight to bring those nations in line. And the third reason why this could be a year of more conflict is this could finally be the year that we see the great Southern European revolt. And this is something that has been around for, or been a potential for a while now, that Germany has thus far managed to clamp down on every time it has threatened to break out. But the gist is this. You know, Germany has Europe's largest population, largest economy, and that generally leads it to dominate the EU. And we just saw this very clearly demonstrated in the Euro crisis. But there's still the potential for Southern Europe. There are still steps that they could take to defy Germany, leaving the EU being one. But they could just ignore EU rules and take various steps and just say, well, you stop us. People have come very close to doing that. Greece came really close to doing that. They voted in a referendum, again, basically just to defy Germany. But thus far, Germany has always managed to make these countries back down. Again, in Greece's case, the prime minister was so scared that if he followed through on the referendum result, that Germany would back a coup against him. That's what the Greek finance minister wrote in his book. And so Greece backed down. They didn't follow through on that referendum, and this revolt was stopped. Well, Italy could now be getting ready to defy Germany. Ambrose Evans Pritchard had an article in this morning's Telegraph, Italy's resurgent Eurosceptics plot to subvert monetary union from within. Italy is getting ready for an election on March 4th, and the Eurosceptic forces look like they're going to win an overwhelming majority. Now, recently, they got together, these different Eurosceptic parties, and they all put out various different position papers. What a lot of people took from that is they said, well, we're not going to advocate leaving the euro. And a lot of people kind of breathed a sigh of relief. Okay, we're all good. You know, they're not going to try and leave the euro. But, well, but what they do want is potentially every bit as damaging from Germany's point of view. This article by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he writes, Italy's ascendant populists on left and right have shelved their immediate plans to leave the euro. They are plotting instead to subvert monetary union from inside with parallel currencies and deficit spending in open violation of the Maastricht Treaty. This is equally dangerous for Germany and for the political construction of Europe and is far more likely to happen, or far more likely to happen than leaving the euro. Basically, it seems like they've looked at the French election and they've seen that, okay, voters may be upset about Europe, they may not like the euro, but if you stand on a platform of wanting to quit the euro, that's too radical for some. They don't like it, but they're kind of too scared to take that big step and leave the euro. He writes that all of these parties, the rebel forces jockeying for power in the election on March 4th, currently lead the polls by a wide margin. Between them, they command two-thirds of the electorate. All view the euro system as a racket largely in the interests of Germany. They intend to fight back by gaming the EU themselves with matching cynicism and Machiavellian astuzia. The Eurosceptic revolt should come as no surprise. And he talks about what Italy's economy has been through. Its output is still 6% below where it was in 2008. All these other countries have been growing on recovered growth, but not Italy. The tangible reality for most Italians, he writes, is even worse, since the real disposable income per capita has not yet returned to the levels of 1995, when the lira was fixed perpetually against the Deutschmark. So they all the Italian people are worse off because of the euro. A quarter of a century of depression explains why the pro-European centre is withering on the vine, he writes. So Beppe Grillo's five-star movement is leads the polls with 28%. Then there's a right-wing coalition of Forza Italy, Liga and Brothers of Italy. They're at 38%. And Silvia Berlusconi is part of that movement. He writes, nobody knows what will emerge from the splintered landscape other than a hung parliament, but the thrust of policy is clear. All the economic proposals discussed ahead of elections point in one direction, a sharp increase in the public deficit. Now, Germany has strict rules on what, or the Eurozone has strict rules on what states can borrow. But all of Italy's big parties, they're talking about borrowing way more and getting around those rules. Austerity is going to stop completely, because if it doesn't stop, the Italian economy will die. That's Liga's economics chief, Claudio Borghi. He says, we are not Greece, we are a much bigger country, and we are net contributors to the EU budget. So how is Brussels going to stop us? And what they're talking about doing is basically a scheme of almost printing their own money. They would come up with some Italian treasury notes, and the government would issue these. The government would accept these instead of taxes or to purchase goods from government companies. So Italy, for example, owns a massive oil company, Eni. You'd be able to pay for your oil with these. So this is a way for Italy to get around the control of the European Central Bank, to get around Europe's debt rules on how much it can borrow. This is, again, I think the Liga's economics chief. So this is one of the political parties, one of the big political parties, economics spokesman. And he said, if people say this looks very like a parallel currency, who am I to disagree? So that's basically what this is. It's a parallel currency, a new currency. So they still use the euro, but then they introduce their own currency so that they can basically print their own money, use that to borrow. Ambrose Evans Pritchard also writes, for good measure, Italy will pass legislation stipulating that the Italian constitution must have primacy over EU law. Another provocation to Europe. And they do have, without this kind of thing, they face a tough year ahead. He points out that Italy has to refinance a huge amount of debt next year. 17% of their economy is the equivalent. They need to refinance debt, and nobody wants to buy it. The European Central Bank has been buying it, but they stopped just towards the end of last year. So who are they going to get to buy those debts? Now, he does write that hung elections may throw up another technocratic government that buys more time in Italy, yet it's hard to avoid the conclusion that the EU is close to losing Italy. The emotional cord is broken. Europe dodged a bullet in the first round of the French elections last year when 48% issued a cri du cœur that was in large part against the EU system. The next test may be harder to handle. So you can see a big revolt from Italy against Germany this year. But now go back to South Tyrol, and we mentioned how it crosses those fault lines. You've got Austria and Germany. backing South Tyrol being part of Austria, and you've got Italy wanting it to keep it as part of their territory. And so then think about, well, if Italy made a move like this or responded to the Eurozone by defying Germany, printing their own money, basically, something that, as you said here, would subvert the ECB's control over the monetary supply and rapidly destroy German consent for the Euro project. So something that would cause major, that Germany would absolutely hate. Well, how would they respond in, say, South Tyrol? Would they respond by trying really, you know, recognizing it as part of Austria? Mr. Fraser wrote about this in a short article back in 2012. He wrote, "From Rome and Berlin, the new dominant axis in Europe, German foreign policy reports that cries for the ceding of the Germanic Italian province of South Tyrol from Italy and its realignment as an Austrian province are escalating in the wake of the Euro crisis. This move has been historically supported by Berlin." And it is the Euro crisis that has really led to tensions increasing this area. And Italy is accusing Austria of preparing to take the territory if the Eurozone falls apart. That Italy kind of doesn't mind, or that Austria can tolerate Italy holding this province while they're all part of the Eurozone and they're kind of part of this semi-super state anyway. But if it were to fall apart, that they try and grab it for themselves. So you've got the potential for just unprecedented conflict and division within Europe. But why are we talking about this? You know, if you're familiar with what we've talked about at the Trumpet, you know, we talk about Europe uniting. We talk about a coming European superstate. Whenever you have people like Jean-Claude Juncker come and lay out their visions of a European superstate, we draw attention to it. We say, look at what they want. Look at what they're planning for. Why would we be looking for conflict in 2018? Well, the EU right now looks very different to this planned European or this coming European superpower. And this kind of conflict could bring apart the radical changes that would see this coming European superpower. Here's a really interesting clip from a very recent Key of David by Mr. Gerald Flurry. This was from, I'm trying to remember the title, it was something like The World's Biggest Empire is Hidden, from, I think it was just December, so a very recent quote.
We wrote an article in thetrumpet.com by Joshua Michels, and that's November 13, 2017, and he says, "The German military strategists prepare for the European Union and the United States of America to fall. They don't have confidence in America. And they know that the European Union is going to fall apart. They now have 27 nations, and God says there will only be 10 kings in that Holy Roman Empire. It's going to be pared down greatly. 10 kings. Now you can count to 10. We can all count to 10 and just watch it all happen. It's going to happen before your eyes, and God says they are going to..."
So Germany's getting, you know, their military is doing studies, getting ready for the European Union to fall apart. And as Mr. Flurry says there, that could well happen. The European Union could fall apart, could collapse. Revelation chapter 17 is where it talks about 10 kings. Revelation 17, for example, it's in verse 10, it says, "There are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he will continue a short space." So here, there are seven different powers, seven kings chronologically. So you have an empire that is resurrected seven times, that's there and goes away and then comes back again. And that's what you see in Europe. You had this empire led by the Catholic Church, led by the Church of Rome. You have the Emperor Justinian. You had Charlemagne, Otto the Great, the Habsburg Empire, Napoleon, who signed a concordat with the Vatican, anointed Holy Roman Empire by Emperor by the Pope. You then have the whole period with Mussolini in Italy and Hitler in Germany in World War I, World War II. And then you're having the seventh power now rising in Italy. And describing the seventh power, it says that the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour, with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength to the beast. So 10 kings that reign together, not chronologically now, but they all rule together for a short time, for 1 hour. They all rule together and they have one mind. They give their power to this combined superstate. 10 kings all sharing power. And there's a couple of things we can note here. First of all, it's 10 kings. Europe currently is 28 nations. Even when Britain's left, that's down to 27. Way more than 10. So that alone shows something big has got to happen to get it down to 10. But then also these are 10 kings. This is something we've been drawing attention to recently. We had our recent trumpet print edition that talked about the rise of the strong man. And in there, we drew attention to, Mr. Flurry's talked about on this show quite a few times. When the Bible talks about kings, it's not talking about democratic leaders. It's talking about kings, strong men. So that's what we're looking for in Europe. Kings, autocrats. And again, that implies pretty radical change. How do you have these kings come out of the democratic nations of Europe? And the EU collapsing, or this huge amount, a lot more conflict, well, that could help bring about this revolution for Europe that the Bible prophesies. That's what Mr. Flurry was drawing attention to in that clip that we just played. These kind of conflicts could bring the EU to a point of major crisis. And a crisis that is, as you heard on that one, that clip there, Germany has been preparing for. And in 2008, in the midst of the financial crisis, Mr. Flurry, he wrote that that crises would force Europeans to succumb to a strong government, a strong united government of Europe, led ultimately not from Brussels, but from Berlin. He wrote that the crisis in Greece is a forerunner of a whole rash of similar crises set to soon break out across Europe. They will provide the catalyst for the EU's leading nation, Germany, to rise to the fore with the solutions of its own making. Bible prophecy declares the result will be a European superstate with Germany at the helm. And that is not good news for America, Britain, and the little nation called Israel. So that's what these different divisions could help bring about. You've got various different potential crises in Europe, even conflict. But in this conflict, it can lead to Germany emerging as the head, getting its way over these other nations as it competes with them. Germany becoming more powerful, Germany having to express and use its power much more openly. That's exactly what we're watching now. That's what we're seeing. So keep watching for this. In Europe, you can read much more about this prophecy that I went over fairly quickly in Revelation 17. You can read more about that in our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. Just click on the literature library now. Click on the library tab and then literature at the top right of our website, thetrumpet.com. Go there. We'll ship you that book anywhere in the world for free. More than happy to send it to you. You can download it and read it as well. That will give you the proof that you need to understand what is happening now in Europe, where these different conflicts are leading. We'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll use the remaining time to talk about a major, major shift that's already begun in 2018 between two important powers in Europe.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. In the first half today, we've been talking about Europe and various different conflicts that have the potential to break out there, very serious ones. But now we're going to talk about the opposite, two nations growing closer together. In fact, it's even been called a bromance. So quite the opposite of a conflict right there. And this is Germany and Turkey. This has been popping up all over the news now because they really are strengthening their ties with Europe. 2016, 2017 was a very rocky time between Germany and Turkey. I think really at the heart of this is just the fact that there was that coup attempt in 2016, and Turkey, rightly or wrongly, I think, believes that Germany supported that coup and may have even in part been behind that coup. So that they won't come out, obviously, and accuse them of that openly, but I think that really soured their relationship with Germany. And so in 2017, that ended up being a pretty rough year between the two nations. Lots and lots of tit-for-tat recriminations. You know, Turkey refusing to let German parliamentarians visit their own soldiers in an airbase that they have in Turkey. So then Germany moving the airbase to Jordan. You had Germany arresting, or Turkey arresting German journalists, German citizens who are operating as journalists, locking them up despite even big protests in Germany about it. Germany not letting Turkish politicians come and address their address Turks, trying to get them to vote in a Turkish referendum, then Turkey going off in a big strop about that. Even Turkey trying to sneak some of these members. I think that was into the Netherlands where they tried to sneak one of their ministers in there to give a rally. Turkey, I think, even accused Germany of supporting terrorism. So a very rough year, but then things have recently been improving. In November, the German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier and the Chancellor Merkel, they spoke to Erdogan over the phone, so they started talking again. Gerhard Schröder visited Turkey, the former German Chancellor, on what's been called a semi-secret mission to meet with Erdogan. The Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Cavusoglu, he travelled to Germany just recently. I think it was just a week or so ago, and met with his German counterpart. Meanwhile, the president went and met with President Erdogan. He met with Emmanuel Macron in France, and they all got on well. There were very, very productive meetings. And the German foreign minister, Sigmar Gabriel, he was so keen to impress his Turkish guest that he even went out and bought a Turkish tea set. And he invited him back, I think, to his own home. I think it was one of the first times he's ever invited a foreign guest to his hometown. And he served him tea on this Turkish tea set. And the pictures were shown all around the world of the German foreign minister pouring tea for the Italian foreign minister. And Italy was pretty chuffed about those pictures, showing them getting served by Germany. I think that really kind of stoked their national pride a bit. And that was where Politico wrote their article, "The Beginnings of a Turkish-German Bromance." Turkey and Germany's relationship has just had a huge turnaround in the beginning of 2018. Now, who could have forecast this? Well, if you have a regular listener to our show, you probably remember that right in the midst of all of this disagreement, at the height of the disagreement in 2017, we had a whole program on Germany and Turkey on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And we said, you know, this antagonism is not going to last. It's going to turn around. These two countries need each other. They've historically had good relations. Furthermore, the Bible prophecy tells us that they're going to have good relations. An understanding of history shows, you know, this bromance as it was back then between Erdogan and Putin. That's not going to work. It's going to fall apart. We said that. Now you're having headlines. Let me just find it quickly. This is from Geopolitical Futures, January 11th. Turkey breaks with Iran and Russia. Now, we called it. We said that that was going to happen. We had an article in the Trumpet Print as well called Pivotal Power, talking about how there was no future in this Turkish-German relationship. I mean, this Turkish-Russian relationship, that they were going to turn to Germany instead. And these have been one of the two big stories of 2018, this break with Russia and then this bromance, as Politico called it, with Germany. Why did we say that again? We said Bible prophecy. Listen to this quote we'll just play quickly from a Key of David program. I think this is from 2013, at least several years ago. And back then, Turkey was again drawing closer to Iran. And listen to what Mr. Flurry, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, said with great authority about what was going to happen between Turkey and Germany.
But Turkey, again, has been allied with Iran. But why would they be siding up to Germany? Well, because they disagree with Iran in this revolution that's going on. They're behind and support the rebels, while Iran supports the Assad regime. So there, it looks like there's problems between Turkey and Iran, and of course we know there's going to be, because Turkey's going to be allied with Germany. And Germany is driving a wedge between those two great countries, Turkey and Iran. What does that mean to people in this world? Well, it means very little, because they don't know what's going on. But God prophesied all of it and spells it out and says, if we'll just study our Bibles, we can understand that. We must understand it. God has his little treasured ones or sheltered ones there because he protects them. And they understand it. Do you understand this? We really do need to. Well, you watch what happens in with Turkey and Germany and all of these other nations. Just watch and see what happens and see if they don't break away from Iran. And after Germany defeats Iran, then they're all going to already virtually be allied with Germany. You see, those things don't happen overnight. It takes time. And Germany has been laying that groundwork for many years. And that you can prove from your world news. It's just that it flies under the radar most of the time. People don't realize what's really happening. But we're talking about a massive shift in nations of this world and events that are going to just stagger the imagination of many authorities in this world. And God had it all planned out long ago, or prophesied long ago. He let others do a lot of the planning.
So you watch. You watch, he said. You watch and see what happens. They're going to break from Iran, and they're going to ally with Germany. And then just those two headlines again. From exactly the same day, January 11th, the same day, one headline, Turkey breaks with Iran and Russia. Next headline, beginnings of a Turkish-German bromance. Bible prophecy in two headlines. And it's not just, say, the surface ties, surface relationship between these two. As I talked about in that Pivotal Power article that we published back over in the summer, there's much deeper military ties between the two, and these are getting stronger. One of the two things they talked about over at this meeting was a project for Rheinmetall, a contract to upgrade a whole bunch of Turkish tanks. There's a lot of German arms companies not just working with or selling weapons to Turkey, but setting up setting up factories for Turkey. Rheinmetall is helping Turkey develop its own tank manufacturing plants, for example. So there's a much deeper defense relationship there. And you can see why. Turkey is in so many ways at odds with Russia. Its needs are at odds with Russia. Meanwhile, at the same time, it's kind of falling out a bit with the United States over the Kurds in Syria. So they're moving closer to Germany and to Europe. Now, there's another article as well, just talking about, this was Al Monitor from January 10th, do improved ties with Germany, France, signal an end to Turkey's EU bid. And that also ties into Bible prophecy. Again, we've said for years they're going to be allied with Germany, but at the same time, we've said they won't be part of this coming European power. because the Bible is very clear. This European power is a Christian power. It's allied, it's ruled by the Catholic Church. And so we were very clear that they would not be a part of that. And now that's exactly what you see happening in the news. Turkey moving away from a relationship with Russia, with Iran, towards a relationship with Europe. But at the same time, it's clear they're not going to be a part of the EU. You know, just absolutely and precisely what we've been saying for years based on Bible prophecy. Now, you can read more of that prophecy in that article, Pivotal Power. That contains more, and it contains some links that you can go and use to prove who Turkey is. In the Bible, Turkey is the descendants of the modern of biblical Edom. They're often called Timan in the Bible, and the one name for the Turks historically has been the Ottomans, coming directly from that term Timan. So they're talked about a lot in the Bible. Psalm 83 talks about Edom being allied with Germany. The entire book of Obadiah, it has some deep spiritual prophecy there, but it also has some specific prophecy for Turkey and about how they will ally with Germany. And okay, if you're not used to prophecy, that may seem far-fetched. But again, just compare those headlines that we read now to Mr. Flurry on that Key of David based on Bible prophecy from several years ago. This is Bible prophecy being fulfilled in very clear, obvious ways right before your eyes. So you can study more into that. That article is called Pivotal Power. As I said, that will lead you into some earlier articles that we've written that go in much more detail as to Turkey's background in the Bible. Study into that, and that's just a great way to prove the Bible is relevant and accurate to today's events. Well, thanks for listening. It's been an enjoyable show for me. There's a lot to pack in there. Hopefully it's been interesting to listen to. Keep listening, please, and you can tune in again tomorrow here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial and online at kpcg.fm.